He's been practicing jokes, so.
Oh, no.
That's perfect. That was a good distance, too. It was right in the bandwidth it should be for volume.
I'm ready for it now.
Ready for a countdown?
No.
No? I have a funny one.
Uh-oh.
If you use your noodle, the possibilities are unlimited.
Ew.
Scott loves it!
Thank you, Don.
I knew it was coming. He said that to me last night, and I went, you're going to put that on the podcast, aren't you?
Now I know you're a Pastafarian.
Oh, that's true.
That's true.
Yes.
Shall we get started? You want to count it down?
Let me count it down.
Go for it.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Hi, this is Chris Harmer of Harmer Show Auctions, and I'm at Stamp Show here today.
It's hard to send up. It's hard to send up.
Stamp collecting happens when we dream together.
Welcome to Stamp Show here today, episode number 65. I'm sitting here with Scott, Cash, and Jeff, and I'm your host, Dawn. You can find us on Facebook at Stamp Show Here Today and on Twitter at Stamp Show HT, or you can call us and leave a message at country code 1-949-873-4298. Tell your friends they can find us on iTunes, Podbay, Stitcher, and many more.
And I found out that if you are listening to us on iTunes and you click the subscribe button, you will go to heaven.
That cricket thing would have come in handy.
I know, it would have.
Yeah, but that's a true fact.
It's a true fact.
A true fact.
So let's talk about stamps. This week, we will be talking about stamp news, a Smithsonian marijuana stamp sells at auction, hashtag stamp stories, my freaks and errors, Cash's corrections, and our expert topic this week is a discussion about the importance of the internet to stamp collectors. So stamp news. A Smithsonian throwaway gets a second life at auction. While some of our listeners have been lucky enough to see the exhibits at the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C. in person, most people are only dimly aware that the Smithsonian holds a vast amount of antiques and rarities in its vaults that have never been seen in public. This holds true for the Postal Museum as well. In 2004, the Smithsonian was looking to get rid of some of their stamps and had announced that January that they planned on destroying 7.3 million U.S. revenue stamps by fire to save space. Of course, this news was not received very well by the stamp collecting public.
Yeah, and it would be insurance fraud.
Really?
Well, you set fire to your own property and claim it for insurance, yeah.
Where are the crickets?
I know.
Some crickets?
That was just bad. Mine might have been unfunny, but that was just bad.
Collectors responded to the news with dozens of letters urging the museum not to burn the stamps, but to give collectors the opportunity to buy them. Eric Jackson, one of the world's leading revenue stamp dealers, mounted an internet campaign against the destruction, denouncing the proposal as philatelic vandalism. Upon closer examination of the stamps in question, and in response to pleas from stamp collectors, the museum changed its plan to destroy the stamps and decided instead to sell or give to other museums 6.3 million stamps. We learned from Lynn's Stamp News just this last year, a $100 federal marijuana tax stamp from 1937 from the Smithsonian was brought to auction in November 21st, 22nd sale conducted by Regency Superior at Chicago PEX Show. The marijuana tax stamps were produced by overprinting United States documentary stamps of 1917 and were intended to enforce regulation of cannabis. The stamps sold at auction for $510. Thanks to the efforts of Eric Jackson and other philatelic activists, this stamp and others were saved from a fiery fate and have made their way into the hands of very grateful collectors of the world over. Hopefully someday we will get to see the last of the Smithsonian revenue stamps sold at auction as well.
Yeah, this was highly, highly controversial when it first came out.
Oh, I bet.
There were a lot of items there. Again, this was the Internal Revenue Service basically said, we're not in the stamp business anymore. So they had printed all these stamps. And the marijuana stamp has a different story, but there were a lot of like document stamps and stuff like that. And they said, we have these. We're not going to be enforcing this law anymore. They're stamps. Ship them to the Smithsonian. And I remember speaking with Wilson Hume, who passed away in 2005, I believe it was, or 2005. But before it, it was really a question because there were some very, very rare items.
Ooh.
And then all of a sudden, at the Smithsonian, you know, there is a stamp that, you know, five exist. And all of a sudden, he looks and he's got 100 sheets of it.
Oh, my God.
So then the question is, you know, do I destroy the value of these five stamps or 10 stamps or whatever by releasing 100 sheets? So they went through their information and they literally decided which ones they would sell, which ones they wouldn't, and in what quantities.
Yeah, but I think part of that is a lot of the revenue stamps that existed were all used. And the ones that they were selling were obviously mint.
Mm-hmm.
And so I question whether it really would have destroyed the value the way they thought it would, because the used copies are the used copies, and most collectors well, there's, you know, three types of collectors: one who collects mint, one who collects used, and one who doesn't care.
Well, but let's
as long
take
as they fill a spot.
Yeah, but let's take marijuana tax stamps. Marijuana tax stamps were the second issue, I believe, was never sold. The first issue was sold incredibly rarely. What it was a technicality. They said, if you have marijuana, you have to have a marijuana tax stamp. Well, nobody's going to buy the tax stamp because the marijuana is illegal. So then everybody could say, okay, this is illegal marijuana. We're going to throw you in jail.
Mm.
We have the ability to put stamps on this. So if you don't, it just means you're a criminal. The fact is that they were using it as a technicality to bust people, and Leary took it to court and said, you know, this is self-incrimination because I have to tell you I have marijuana instead of you actually having to go through the legal process of finding it. And it was thrown out, and that's what brought an end to the marijuana tax stamps. There were quite a few other stamps that were used incredibly rarely or that had gone out of business, like wine stamps. The way they taxed alcohol changed dramatically, and so they didn't need wine stamps anymore. So at the very end, there were some incredibly rare wine stamps that when they went to the Smithsonian, they go, we have piles of sheets of this. And these were mint, so it would have destroyed value of mint stamps. And in the end, they used their best judgment and parceled out what they thought would be a fair amount. And they raised a lot of money for the Smithsonian. So
that doesn't sound like a bad thing to me. If that was an area I collected, I'd be begging that they'd release those.
Mm-hmm. Unless you had one of the rare stamps.
Yeah, then you're only pissing off five people instead of what? A thousand, 10,000 of them?
But pissing off five people with lots of money.
Yeah. So it was highly controversial. And if they have one more sale that's coming, I'm very curious as to why they have one more sale, because they were supposed to dispose of everything after their past sale so that people would be able to understand about what the supply of these stamps are, how many of them are out there.
Well, supposedly, Lynn says it's the Smithsonian claims that they've been incredibly busy with other stuff and they haven't been able to get around to it. So we'll see.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Okay, time for hashtag stamp stories, hashtag my freaks and errors. We tend to talk a lot about the Freaks and Errors movie that is scheduled to debut at the New York 2016 Stamp Show. In addition about the movie, we started thinking about some of our own favorite freaks, errors, and oddities. Take, for example, a U.S. Scott number 1054. Usually this is a very common stamp. It was printed as part of the Liberty series of 1954 and is a one-set green coil stamp featuring Washington and typically not worth very much. However, there is one example that seems to baffle even the best of experts. There is a specimen in existence that seems to have gotten printed on both sides. The face is completely normal, but there is a clear printing of the stamp also on the back that is not a mirror image, but is printed upside down compared to the face. The way these stamps were printed seems to make this error impossible. The stamps were printed on a long roll of continuously fed rolls of paper called a web, and would never have had a second chance to pass through the printer, as once they were out, they were done. This copy is unique because while wet ink transfers do happen, they are usually on the gum or are not very strong. Sometimes the print can get transferred if the stamps are really wet when stacked. This example, though, is very clear and seems to have been actually printed on the paper itself. This mystery has stumped even the greatest freaks and errors specialist, including our friend John Hotchner. If you have any ideas, by the way, feel free to look him up and offer some help. He always welcomes outside opinions. So what are some of our favorite freaks, errors, and oddities?
Well, we actually, and this was from Jerry Connolly, I believe it was. He had an 8-cent, who had the 8-cent Columbian that was printed on both sides?
It doesn't matter.
Oh, well, shout out to Jerry.
it wasn't Jerry.
Even if it wasn't you, shout out to you anyway. The stamp was, usually if you have a wet printing, you put a stamp on top of it, the stamp will transfer to the back. It's called offset or whatever.
It's called set off.
It'll set off. And it's usually a mirror image. Everything is backwards. So instead of United States, it would be, and it says oof. And, you know, so everything is backwards. The twos are backwards. Everything is backwards. This one was fully printed, and it was on top of the gum. And it was very, very odd because we were sitting there going, this isn't a printed on both sides because it's on top of the gum.
Mm-hmm. And at that time, stamps were gummed after they were printed.
Right. So somebody took a gum sheet, put it inside of the printing press, and printed on the back of it. It didn't look clear enough to call that. But we could not figure out.
There's no way it was that because the...
Yeah, because it wasn't a full, complete image.
So the best guess was that...
It got offset twice or something
It was
that.
It was a double set-off.
And so a double set-off, which, you know, who the hell knows if that's even possible. but it seemed like a great explanation. You know, it's the same sort of thing here. How do you run a piece of paper through the printer twice unless somebody just said, hey, I'm going to take this and put it through a second time. Wahoo. You know, I'm going to create an error. But other, and I don't even see how you could do that. I mean, you would literally have to take the piece of paper and shove it into the printing mechanism while it was all shooting through the machine.
At a million miles an hour.
At a million miles an hour, right. So, yeah, this is incredibly interesting. And that 8-cent Columbian is the same thing in my mind where I just have no clue how it happened. So that's my favorite error.
Well, mine happened to be the imperf errors of Transportation and Liberty Coil series. Both of them. I like them.
I can't remember what series it is. It was, I think, from the 70s, but I have a Roosevelt stamp where it's a perforated coil and the perfs are split right down the middle of his face.
I've got a bunch of those. Mm.
So they're not incredibly rare. It's like a $20 little item. I mean, you can find some fun little things like that if you want to get into the easy freaks and errors, things that were miscut or... What other ways? What other things are easy, cheap freaks and errors to get, things that go wrong with stamps?
Well, obviously, shifted perforations that don't rise to the level of an error, where the, you know, like you said, you get perforations on a coil that cut the stamp in half instead of around the outside.
Misregistered colors also were pretty
common. Oh, yeah, I have a couple of those.
You can get sheet stamps that do the same thing. And if they're off in two or three directions, then you have parts of four different stamps on one stamp.
Oh, that'd be cool.
That's kind of cool.
I can see those costing a little more.
I've got a D.W. Griffith stamp where the colors are misregistered. And it's really freaky because it looks like there's about three impressions of the stamp because of the way the colors came out. But they're shifted significantly. And it's kind of striking when you look at that. And another one I have along the lines of the 8-cent Columbian that Kaz was talking about, I have an airmail from, it's like C89, I think, or somewhere around there. And it's the set off on the back is so heavy, it looks like it was printed. I mean, it is clear as day. The entire image, fully inked and fully set off on top of the gum.
Cool.
What are your favorite freaks, errors, and oddities? Have any that you want to share? Post it to Facebook and Twitter, hashtag stamp stories, hashtag my freaks and errors. Cash.
Well, hail fellows well met. The last episode, we were going into coils, and I got a little bit of a feedback online. And I want to tell you guys that I really like the story behind stamps. And when I'm sitting here, I'm really talking about the story behind stamps. So we actually have at PSE an award that we give out, and it's called It's Not Just Stamps. And we're trying to promote the story behind it. The people who, you know, wanted us to get more specific into coils and stuff, that's more along the lines of stamps for people who can't fall asleep. And so that's what we kind of actually work on avoiding at the podcast. The second one, and this is from quite a few episodes ago, but it just came to my attention. We were discussing Persian rug revenues. And I am going to retract my Cash's correction, because I always thought that the $2.50 red and green revenue was a Persian rug. And everybody corrected me that it wasn't a Persian rug. Well, it turns out it is a Persian rug. It's called the baby rug.
No.
Yes, it's in printing. I have it right here. It's in printing in the U.S. Classic Society. So I have the U.S. Classic Society on my side that it is a Persian rug. It's just the baby rug.
I've heard that term before.
The third thing is we were discussing newspaper stamps. And if the wrapper is the first, I wanted to look this up because I'm going to, like, I love putting little stamp stories together. And the first newspaper stamp, I'm going to change, and I'm going to write up, the first newspaper stamp was W20. It was a wrapper made in 1861, and that was for sending newspapers. So that is our first newspaper stamp, and I'm going to write a little thing up on that. The last thing is, this is interesting because I saw these on eBay, is Russia during the Tsarist, when the Tsar was getting overthrown, they printed stamps, and they printed them on sort of a thin cardboard, and on the back it said, use this for gold currency. Well, it came to my attention that there some of the coin expertizing companies are grading these. And it's very interesting because I'm looking at one right now. They'd got a grade of 66. Now, you have to realize that in coins, it goes to a grade of 70. So a 66 is like superb.
Is it single digit? So there's a 66, 67, 68,
yes,
69?
70. Yes. This is not what we would consider a superb stamp or an extra fine stamp. It's slightly off center and stuff like that. So be aware that coin people.
It's actually a fine centered stamp.
Well, it's a little better than the fine, but
no, it's not.
It's definitely not a 66, that's for sure. And
I'm holding it up to the microphone, everybody. So,
yeah. Yeah, and PMG is a very big currency grading group. So this is something that's very interesting because the currency people are grading stamps, and if we grade these also, so I guess we're a stamp company that grades currency. And the last thing is a gift for Jeff.
Uh-oh.
I have here.
What is this? Hey, so now I know what a grist mill is.
A grist mill stamp.
Cool, thank you.
Used, of course.
I had to actually look this up on Wikipedia to find out what it is.
And the last thing is we have a little giveaway for anybody who sends us, let's say, another piece of fan mail or something, first person who gets it to us. I got some 1964 Alfred E. Newman for President stamps. And these are cool because it was the presidential campaign of 1964 of Goldwater versus Johnson. And this is election season for us. So, you know, we're looking at Barry Sanders versus Donald Trump. And I'm predicting the future.
I would tend to agree with you.
And so I have these, and anybody who writes in who wants one, you know something, anybody who wants one, just send a self-addressed stamped envelope.
Hey, there you go.
And because I will send you an Alfred E. Newman for President stamp.
Just make sure it's big enough to hold a stamp card.
And that's it.
And now our expert topic, the internet and stamp collecting. The modern internet is 25 years old, going on 26 this March.
Happy birthday.
Woohoo!
It's a bunch of tubes, right? Didn't somebody say that once?
Where are the crickets?
There are no tubes in the internet.
We're going to right wear those crickets out.
There we are.
What is that? Is that a YouTube clip?
Yeah.
You're going to give them so many frickin' hits.
Besides the routine Google searches, Facebook posts, tweets, and email inboxes, the internet has become a major source of information for stamp collectors. As with anything online, sometimes there can be too much information. Just try searching U.S. postage stamp in Google. 16.3 million results is a lot of information. Understanding where you are going online looking for stamp help, no matter what you need, is vital to today's philatelist. So, what can the average stamp collector get out of the internet? One, internet is a tool like tongs or a magnifying glass. Two, the ability to conduct vast research that would not have been available in any one place to any one person 20 years ago. Three, knowledge that helps the collector learn more on their area, knowledge that can protect them later on. Four, the social aspect, the ability to join large online communities of people that collect the exact same thing you do.
Kaz, you kind of had an analogy for that too, didn't you?
Yeah, and we're going to discuss that down below, so let's use it down below.
Okay.
And last but not least,
the ability to buy millions of stamps at your fingertips.
Oh, yay.
That's dangerous. It really is.
What are the pros of using the internet? We will give you our top 10 favorite stamp websites.
Scott, why don't you start?
How about the post office in Paradise, hawaiianstamps.com?
Oh, excellent choice.
Oh, yeah.
Excellent
that is a choice. Good one.
Anything you want to know about Hawaiian stamps, how to tell the forgeries from the genuine ones, it's a great, great research site.
I have to agree with that. I'm going to pick Philippines. I'm not sure. I believe it's philippines.com.
It's
philippinephilatelist.net. Sorry.
Well, that's different.
Philippinephilatelist.net. They list a lot of the provision or the, excuse me, the possessions along with the Philippines. I enjoy the Philippines. I have a stamp store called philippinestampstore.com. I'm really interested in the Philippines. I love the Philippines. So that's mine that I'm going to say the website that I can't do without for my personal use.
Well, on top of that, that's another site that's great for research because some of those overprints have been faked. And again, it's a good resource for weeding out a lot of the fakes that could possibly land in your collection. So, again, a great research site.
Okay, well, my favorite that I use frequently is the SwedishTiger.com, which is kind of a misnomer because the name doesn't have anything to do with stamps. But it is a United States stamp identification website. He's done an excellent job with his research and image posting. You can find a lot of information on U.S. classics and platings. He has an extensive image library that helps you identify classics that you might be looking at. And he has very easy to use system of if-thens that I like to use. If you have a stamp with this design and these perforations, then it could be this, this, or this. So when I have a hard time with the U.S. stamp and I don't want to have to sit there and dig through physical books, depending on what it is, I could just hop on to his website, theswedishtiger.com, and usually get an answer pretty quickly.
Yeah, I wish I knew who did this website, because it really is an outstanding website. And I don't know who does it, but whoever does it really knows their 1851 issue, which is what I collect. And I'm kind of curious if I've ever met him before.
Do we know his name?
Swedish Tiger. Oh. First name Swedish, second name Tiger.
Oh, my gosh.
Don?
Well, I have, I came across this site, you know, and being a new collector, and there's a lot of information that's too confusing for me. But this site, it's at about.com. So you put in stamps.about.com, and it comes up with all kinds of links, and it breaks it down for someone who's, you know, new to the hobby. So I like this one.
Well, the number five that I picked, and this one should be self-evident. It's Google or Bing, either one, for identifying stamps. You can type in 41-cent grist mill stamp and hit the enter.
You won't get anything because it's not a 41-cent stamp.
Or whatever. $4.25 grist mill stamp. Or Greek 2SC stamp with Hermes head on it or something like that. And it will pull up a lot of possibilities, and it will really help you to try to identify stamps that otherwise you have to sit at this Scott's catalog and search for.
Well, I got a story about that. A couple weeks ago, I was looking at a stamp, and it had it in front of me, and I had never seen this stamp before. And so I just typed in the words that were on the stamp, said auditor on it, and I did an image search, and I found out that it was a Louisiana lottery stamp from the Civil War.
Good grief.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Oh, you also brought up something. Here is something for everybody who deals on the computer. This is something that I didn't know until recently. If you find the picture of a stamp, you can go to Google Images, or you go to the Google page, and up in the upper right-hand corner, there's going to be a little button that says Images. Click that, and then you're going to get basically another Google page. The only difference is where you type in whatever you want, there's going to be a little picture of a camera. Click the camera, and it'll say, post here the URL. Take whatever picture you have and put that URL into there. The URL is the address. You know, just the name of the picture.
Put HTTP, whatever.
Put that in there, and it'll show you all the occurrences of that picture on the website. So, like, you pull up the lottery stamp. Mm-hmm. And you go, wow, there's the lottery stamp. Now I know what it is. Well, you still don't have enough information necessarily. So you put that URL into Google Camera Image Search, and it will give you a list of websites, and then you click on it, and you know, then you get the website that talks about it, that actually has that picture in it. Because if you just do Bing or Google, you'll get the picture, but it won't give you the website that it came from.
Or actually, that's not true. It'll give you two options, view image or view web,
yes,
web page.
But here's the hitch with that. Here's the problem. It goes to whatever web page has that. So you could go to the web page that says, wow, I found interesting stamps. I have no clue what this stamp is. Here's a picture of it.
Or it might be Pinterest.
Or it could be Pinterest.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Or, you know, somebody took a picture and put it on Flickr or something like that.
So now you have a picture, but it's a dead end because there's no information attached to it.
Exactly. So if you put that URL into that camera search, you may get 10 of them, and it'll say, full discussion, everything you ever wanted to know about the Civil War lottery stamp. You click on that one, and all of a sudden, boom, you got everything. So that's a tool that if you get nothing out of this podcast, and hopefully at least you get half an hour of entertainment or 20 minutes if we're a half an hour show, you know, 10 minutes of it you can ignore. But the ability to search and identify stamps through Google and Bing, I think are really the huge things.
Yeah, I've had to do that at least twice. I have two examples that I can think of right off the top of my head. One was a very plain, light tan stamp on white paper. It had a Greek figurehead on it, a bust, and then it had the kind of Iconian tessellation, the Greek pattern around the border. No idea what it was. I think it just had like the number 2 on it, nothing else. So I put into Google, tan stamp with Greek head with number 2, right into Google. And it took about 5 minutes, and I was able to dig through and find the freaking thing. It turns out, I think it was like a European newspaper stamp. Mm-hmm. So I was able to find that one. Then I had another one that I got close on that Scott ended up finishing off. It was an orange stamp that had post horns on it. And the denomination, and no clue as to what currency it was. And I got really close using Google search with that. Scott was able to finish it off for me almost instantly, darn it. but again, I just put in orange stamp, post horn, and then the denomination. And I got myriads of information. And it was just a matter of finding which the right one was at that point. So just put in what, looking at it, what does it look like? And you will get information that will point you in the right direction eventually.
And it beats the hell out of going through 7 1,000-page Scott catalogs.
Which I tried and was not able to do.
Yeah.
Okay, and number 6, I'm going to bring up, I actually use a lot of resources at gradingmatters.com. There's a couple of good things there. One of them is going to be the online SMQ, and one of the reasons it works out really well for U.S. stamps is besides the prices for graded stamps, if you look at the values listed on the in the online SMQ in the grade of 80 for whatever gum condition the stamp is, that is the current Scott catalog value of that stamp. So it is a instant way to look up the Scott catalog value of just about any U.S. stamp. Just go there, go to the SMQ online button, put in the Scott number, and you will have in the grade of 80 the Scott catalog price. And then if it's a little bit better version, you can get an idea of what it can be worth if it's graded too.
And what does SMQ stand for?
Stamp Market Quarterly, the guide to pricing points for United States graded stamps. And the other part that helps with Grading Matters also is there are links on there that take you to some of our in-depth research work on grading and fault detection on stamps as well. And if you go to the full section on that topic through the website, it's fairly easy to find. It's one of the links near the top. You will get a digital version of a book that PSE used to produce that talks about grading and fault detection and all kinds of little identification tips and tricks for stamps. And that was really, really helpful early on, being able to find that information online. And what's nice is it's search friendly too. I think you can actually do, if you put into a Google search bar, you can put Grading Matters as one word and then the topic you're looking for, and it'll usually pull it up. There was something I was looking for once that was kind of unique. I can't remember what it was. But I put in a search term for something I was trying to identify, and that was the first place it popped up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something that nowhere else had that information either. So there are interesting little unique bits that you can find on there as well.
Well, number 7 that I have here, and really I think 7, 8, and 9 are almost ties. They're so close to each other. But number 7 is definitely Wikipedia. I found out about Chicken Alaska with Wikipedia. I got a Lloyd's of London insurance form with a bunch of revenue stamps on it. And it was for a ship, obviously, from Lloyd's of London. And the ship, I pulled it up on Wikipedia, and I found out all the history of the ship, plus the fact that it sunk in World War II and stuff like that. There was another ship for an Arctic expedition. I got a postcard. and it had this ship on it. And I go, oh, this is interesting. I wonder, you know, what it is. And I typed it into Wikipedia. And it turned out that this was a postcard that was for a failed Arctic expedition that was in the newspapers. It was like the number one story in 1876 or something like that. You know, just getting the backstory on stuff. And again, you know, I am all about the backstory. I think that stamps without a backstory are boring. I think that stamp collecting is all about the backstory. You can totally disagree, and I will absolutely agree with you. There's no reason why you should agree with me. But the way that I collect, I love the backstory. And because of Wikipedia, now I can get the backstory on all these stamps.
Well, Wikipedia is also nice because it can clarify so many things. Like, you're sitting there, there's some complicated terms in the Scott catalog sometimes. So you're sitting there going, I have this stamp. If this is printed via intaglio printing, what's that?
Yeah.
You can go to Wikipedia and you could look that up. You know what? What's photogravure printing? What's the difference between rotary and flat plate. What's the difference between rotary and flat plate printing? They will tell you.
Or flat plate.
They will tell you, you know, the catalog tells you, okay, this is what the difference looks like when you're looking at the stamp.
Mm-hmm.
You go to Wikipedia and you look that up, and they tell you what the difference was when it was printed, how the machines were different, how each one worked. So you definitely get a better sense of the history, and that's a valuable learning tool. Even when it comes down to expertization, like for U.S. Washington Franklin's, understanding the difference between flat plate and rotary, yes, you can sit there and memorize all the little technical details, but if you spend 2 minutes looking up on Wikipedia the difference between a flat plate and rotary printer, you'll never make the mistake again.
Yes, yeah.
So I definitely am a fan of Wikipedia stamp information.
Well, the next one is, and this is my favorite, and I really don't know of any that are as large or even come close to it. But stampboards.com is a virtual stamp club. It's a blog. It's people who get together and hang out. And, you know, there are other ones like Frijola runs one and stuff like that. That one is a straight line without topics, and everybody talks about stamps. And from my standpoint, they talk about, you know, stamps. It's like, is this, wonder if I find this stamp on laid paper, and I go, yawn. On stamp boards, you know, they'll have, can you identify this stamps? And then the topic right under it will be, should gun control come to Australia? Okay. And it's like, oh, this is cool. This is exactly what I want. I do not want to discuss stamps
as a base dry
all
topic.
All the time.
Yeah.
And I will tell you that the number one topic on this for me is there is a topic on funny photographs.
Oh, no.
And I love the funny photographs. The person who puts it up, I got to give you a shout out because you are the greatest blogger in the world with all these funny photographs. They also talk, obviously, a lot about stamps, but there are a lot of other things. And it really, I mean, people collect stamps as a solo endeavor, but it doesn't, but they don't want it to be a solo endeavor. They want it to be something I can do when I'm alone, something that I can do with people. And if I am alone, I can go online and still interact with people. That interaction is really important. It's what I believe will make stamp collecting attractive in the future. You know, for the younger people, everybody talks about how do you get younger people? Well, you have the interaction. It's belonging to a group of stamp collectors. And so I really, really like stamp boards.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of people that will sit there and say, oh, well, the internet can't replace that face-to-face interaction at a stamp show. Well, I beg to differ. I love stamp shows, don't get me wrong, but I mean, if I can go to Stamp Boards, go to their forum, and hop in a thread where there's 200 people talking about the exact minute thing that I'm interested in, that's as good as a stamp show to me, because now we're all talking about the same thing with the same interest, and it's not random. Go up to somebody, hey, I'm looking for Irish revenue stamps. Oh, no, sorry, I don't do that. No, everybody's talking about the same thing when you narrow down where you're looking. So it's a way to find like-minded people that are after the exact same thing, and it can be very healthy and a lot of fun to participate in these virtual stamp clubs like that.
And the other thing is, it's moderated.
Yes.
So it's very important to have a moderation, because otherwise you'll get some trolls in there, you'll get some flame wars going on. That really doesn't exist. However, I will apologize.
I was just going to say.
Because there was a post that I put up, and there's a certain size of a picture you can put up, and it can't go any larger. And so I said, you know, this is a great stamp. Click here to see it. I would put it up, but the website cannot handle this large of a stamp. And so I put the link in, and you click on it, and it goes to a Rickroll.
Troll!
So I got several comments of, like, laughing, and a couple people didn't understand what was going on, obviously. But, you know, so those were the true ones that got Rickrolled.
Hey, I'm going to click on this picture of a stamp. Never going to give you up. Never going to let you go. Oh, I hate you.
So number nine, I believe that really monumentally changed the stamp collecting world is eBay.
Yeah.
And it's we've gone into the technical part, so if you want to listen to the technical part, we've done buying and selling in great detail a couple episodes ago. Pull it up. But really what eBay has done, in my opinion, is it has made every single stamp collector a potential stamp dealer. Every single person who has a stamp now has an outlet to sell that stamp. And I believe that has a massive appeal to particularly the younger generation, that they are potentially going to find expensive and rare stuff that they can make money on.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what makes hobbies grow, is the ability of an upside. And if you have an ability of an upside like eBay, there, you know, people who are saying, is stamp collecting dying? All you have to do is look at eBay and say, not only is it not dying, it is growing exponentially.
You know what? I went to eBay today and I searched for stamps, browsing by topic. There's over 4 million stamp-related auctions going on right now.
Yeah.
That's not suffering. I'm sorry. But when there's that many, no.
Yeah. You know, people could say, well, stamp shows are suffering, and therefore the stamp collecting is suffering. It's like, okay, that's an opinion. Or they can say, you know, stamp publications are dropping in readership, therefore stamp collecting is dying. It's like, okay. But really, when you look at actual numbers of stamp collectors, stamp collecting is growing, and it's growing really big, and it's growing because of things like eBay.
Yep.
So, number 10. Is Stamp Show Here Today? We have to give ourselves the top 10 spot because it's us.
Yeah, if you've never been to our website, you can go to stampshowheretoday.com. You can listen to all of our episodes. In fact, that is the only way to listen to, I think, our first 20 or 25 so episodes, because iTunes and
right.
Stitcher and Podbay and everybody, they don't carry them past a certain age. So you can go listen to all of our old stuff, make fun of us for our first couple of episodes, and learn a little bit about us in our bios, too. So if you've never been there before, but you listen to us, go check us out. You never know.
You can email us at stampshowheretoday@gmail.com, Twitter stampshowht, Facebook stampshowheretoday, and our website, www.stampshowheretoday.com, with your questions and comments. You can now leave your questions and comments on our Google Voice answering machine anytime, 949-873-4298. There is also a link to Google Voicemail on our website, so you can make the call from your computer. And on that note, keep collecting.
And also, remember to send in a stamped addressed envelope if you want an Alfred E. Newman for President stamp.
Hi, this is Tom Mills, H.R. Harmer Stamp Auctions. You're listening to the podcast for Stamp Show Here Today.
This episode of Stamp Show Here Today is brought to you not only by the Philatelic Book of Secrets, but also by the Philatelic Book of Secrets Volume 2. Volume 2 covers even more secrets that can be bought alone for $10 or together with Part 1 for $15 at gradingmatters.com. Get yours today!
Hi, this is Bobby Prager with Gary Posner Incorporated, based in Long Island, New York, and New Jersey. And I just want to say that the stamp hobby is alive and well here, and we love buying and selling stamps. We pay very, very, very good prices, so we'd rather buy 9 out of 10 collections than just a very small percentage of what we see. Also, check us out on our website at GaryPosnerInc.com. You'll see a lot of great stamps at great prices. And any questions, just feel free to call Bob at 1-800-323-4279. That's Bob Prager at 1-800-323-4279. And my cell number is 917-538-8133. Happy hunting out there.
Address unknown. No such number. No such zone.